Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
Good. I'm not as energized as the first episode that we recorded, but...
Yeah, we've had to record a couple episodes tonight because you're going away.
Yep,
actually, as we're listening to this, you are away.
Yeah, I'm not here for this episode.
You are not in the province.
I'm out of province.
You're way over there towards the left coast.
Yep.
Awesome. Hope you're having a great time.
I'm sure I am. I'm either having a good time or I've been eaten by a grizzly bear.
Oh, don't give me choices now. Do I root for the great time or Derek being eaten by a grizzly bear?
And those listening, there are people at home, so it's not like the house is empty right now, so don't burglarize me.
Right?
That's why I don't like talking about trips beforehand. Because people go, oh, nobody's home, huh?
Okay, for a 50-50 split, I will tell you when nobody's home. Come on, grizzly bear.
Well, you hear about that, too. Like, you know, people are talking. It's like, hey, going on a trip. It's like, oh, empty house.
Uh-huh.
Or, like, I've read about it in the past where people will pour through the obituaries and say,
when's the funeral? Ooh, that's a good, smart idea. I'm getting tired of this 9-to-5.
Yeah.
Thanks for your idea.
All I have to do is look at the obituaries and check out when the funeral is and find who the relatives are. And
well, only you are going on this trip. The rest of the family.
The rest of the family's home.
They're at home being happy and excited. They don't have to deal with your crap for two weeks.
The kids want to go. Well, everybody wants to go too. They all want to go. But they think it's unfair that I'm going on a trip, but they've gotten used to it because I haven't done the Burt Reynolds Memorial River Run in a while, but that was every year, and so early on Beckett was like, I want to go. It's like, you can't go.
Right. Well, I mean, that's me with my Father's Day trip every year and then my Canadian Thanksgiving trip every year.
Yeah.
Right. Thanksgiving birthday trip every year. It just becomes a, where are you going this year? Well, this year I don't think I'm doing a Thanksgiving trip.
No?
Well, no, because I'm going earlier. Well, see, originally where I was going to go here, I was thinking, hey, that'd be a perfect... And then I'm looking at weather and distance and temperatures.
You want a better
and
month.
Way up there.
August is much better.
Yeah. Come October, you're dealing with -5.
Yeah.
no, thank you. No. I don't think so.
It's October. We should go to the Arctic Circle.
Yes. Yeah, sounds like a good plan. Let me just get a dossier on that, shall we?
Yes, and I need a dog team to haul the canoe.
Right? So I just knowing they're checking out weather and temps and stuff like that, and And then, of course, now I've got to, between you going away, the August... lock and paddle event.
Yeah.
And then there's the COTS up in Tomogamy.
Yeah.
And then Tracy going to Japan. And somewhere in all that, I've got to fit.
I think this is the busiest summer we've ever had recording these the episodes.
Yeah. It's like unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we have 1 week between you getting back from out west and you heading out with the family and me heading north.
Yep. Yeah.
We got to somehow put together 4 shows or take time off. I have a plan to put together 4 shows and schedule them all, but it requires the help of other people. So we'll see what happens.
We've only missed recording one time and you
put we made up for it,
a coffee tasting thing with that we did at
Quiet Adventure Symposium.
Quiet Adventure Symposium.
Yep.
So it worked out.
So we've had an episode for every week.
Yep. We've never
in
missed.
In over 10 years.
Yeah.
So we've never missed an episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't want to start now.
I know. Don't want to break the record.
So, what'd you do last night? We recorded 4 hours. See, if it was Andy and Kevin Callan.
Yeah, you could break that into one
nine,
episode.
9 hours of stuff right there. That's 9 shows.
Yeah.
But, no, I got a plan. Yeah. I got a plan.
Excellent.
And I love it when a plan comes together.
I love when the plan comes together.
And if the plan doesn't come together, there's only one finger to point, Derek. We're blaming the cat.
What's the A-Team guy's, George Peppard? I love when the plan comes together. What's the character's name in A-Team? General, no.
There Captain. Was Face. There was...
Wow, so long
Mr.
ago.
T.
Yeah, but that wasn't his character.
There was...
Anyways, George
the pilot guy.
Pilot guy. The crazy guy.
Yeah.
Anyways. I love wow. when the plan comes together. George Peppard. I remember the actor's name. I don't know why I remember his name.
I don't know.
Anyway.
It's no Love Boat. That's what I'm saying.
Love Boat.
Well, all right. Well, let's get through some things here.
Sure.
We got some funky names again going here. I don't know why I do this.
Different country locations or sciencey stuff.
Right?
Sucks trying to pronounce it.
Oh, some of this stuff is... But even still, this stuff, you know, that's exactly how that's spelled. That no way that's... Yeah. Oh, it's not Smith. It's Smyth. What?
It's Smythe.
Smythe. A banca is a traditional Filipino outrigger canoe. Features a narrow wooden hull with bamboo supports on both sides for balance. So it's a canoe with training wheels.
Yes.
A bugse is a Visayan term for a paddle or the act of rowing this boat. Together, they represent a historic method of water travel in the Philippines. For centuries, the sea has shaped Filipino life, with the banca and bugse connecting communities across the archipelago.
Oh, you got it. You've heard that many times.
I'm just going to call it a day now. Today, the Philippine Outrigger Canoe Club, POCC, is reviving that maritime heritage through ocean paddling. Founded in 2021, POCC is a non-stock, non-profit organization dedicated to developing competitive outrigger canoeing while promoting the Philippines' identity as an oceanic nation, guided by its three pillars, culture, community, and conservation. The club combines sport with cultural preservation and environmental stewardship. So we want to revive our ocean culture that has always been deeply rooted in Cebu throughout the Philippines, says POCC president and founding member Faye Jimiera. Based in Barangay Agus, Lapu-Lapu City, POCC welcomes beginners through weekend rookie sessions, providing boats, paddles, safety gear, so anyone can experience the sport. So building it at that grassroots level,
yeah, exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Club also advocates for outrigger canoeing to be introduced in schools to instill discipline, teamwork, and appreciation for the country's seafaring heritage. And knowing what I know now, if that was offered in my school, I'd be out there. Beyond competition, members regularly conduct coastal cleanups, community outreach, educational programs, including the Ocean Love for Kids and Fisher Folk Initiative.
Fisher Folk?
Fisher Folk. We've talked a lot about that lately. A lot of these communities, that's what they are, fisher folk. They fishermen. That's what their livelihood is.
Yeah.
And it seems to be over in that area of the world, it's fisher folk.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This initiative and the Sea of Dreams Scholarship for Student Athletes. POCC will make history by representing the Philippines at the International VA Federation, IVF, World Sprint Championships in Singapore, August 19th to 29th of this year. Marks the country's first official participation as an IVF member federation and the first time the World Championships will be held in Asia. Philippine team will field 19 paddlers competing in individual and team events. However, the club continues to seek sponsors to help fund the delegation's travel and accommodations. That's always the big thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Looking ahead, POCC hopes to establish more canoe clubs nationwide, promote sports tourism, and preserve the Visayan maritime tradition for future generations. For Jimiera and her fellow paddlers, every stroke of the bugse is more than a race. It's a step towards reconnecting Filipinos with their identity as people of the sea. It's amazing how many people around the world have a paddling culture that goes way back.
I know. Well,
and they sort of moved away from it, and now we're
they're
rediscovering, heading back to it.
So it's not really rediscovering. So it became... originally it was what you did as an individual for bringing food home to the family. You went out, you're a fisherfolk, yada, yada, yada. And then in the early 1900s, it became more commercialized. And so it became larger and larger boats, larger and larger groups, more commercial operations. But now what you're seeing, we've seen it a lot with this podcast, is you're seeing people sort of rediscovering the roots. Mm-hmm. Like there's people that are rediscovering old canoe routes. There's people rediscovering old traditions. People, and we're going to talk about
how many
about
people
that.
are building birch bark canoes now.
Exactly.
And relearning exactly. that.
Yep.
Right.
Relearning skills. And you see that, we see that a lot of, it's coming back into they're finding their old traditions and doing it again. And I think that's great. I think it's really good that, that they're doing this to see where they've, you got to know where you came from to know where you're going, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully this all takes off and they can get sponsors and they can keep going and they can get more people involved, especially the young ones, because eventually they got to take, the young ones will be the ones that take over and keep it going, keep it going, keep it going. So, yeah, that's pretty cool. Didn't really want to talk about this, but we gotta. The new reality of wildfires.
Exactly. And we're in the middle of it right now, even as we record. And we talked about it last week with Quetico and Wabakimi. And it's not just parks. Whole communities are burning and people are losing their homes.
Yep.
I fortunately haven't heard about anybody losing their lives yet. We do know of a Canadian firefighter whose helicopter crashed in Colorado 2-3 weeks ago. So there are some lives being lost. But we're seeing a lot more fires. And they're saying that right now they're pre-predicting that this is going to be the worst year on record for wildfires in Ontario. And they've already come out. They predicted that. It's heading that way. They could see how big the fires are, where they're going.
Yeah.
And it's just, they're seeing a lot of these incidents of dry lightning fires where the lightning happens, but it doesn't necessarily rain. And we saw the same thing 2 years ago in Quebec. Was it 2 years ago?
I think so, yeah.
When did we do the fishing trip? The anglers.
Last year. So that would have been 3 summers ago.
That was 3 summers ago. Yeah. So that summer was a lot of Quebec fires.
Yeah.
And it was a string of fires because of a dry lightning storm that traversed an area and left behind a series of, 12 to 18 fires. And the same thing had just happened right from the boundary waters up through north of Wabakimi. And so it's just a sign of the times.
It's everywhere now.
With the climate change and so on, everything is drier. And now it is, so with these forests up north, it is a natural way. That's how these forests restore themselves. Mm-hmm. A lot of these pine cones, they don't open up until they burn. And the burning pops open the pine cones and drops seeds.
Yeah, the jack pine.
It's a natural way for forests to reseed themselves and cause regrowth. So you're going to see a lot of these fire areas in the future. Wabakimi, you're going to see for the next 10 years, it's going to be a lot of birch forests with shrubs and whatever. And then the jack pines come back and they go higher than the birch and the birch die off because the jack pines are closing out the sunlight. It's just a natural progression.
Yep. Big
but
cycle.
We're seeing a lot of it this year. So many fires, big fires, large areas.
So canoe trip and outdoor recreational organizers are coming to terms with this new reality of persistent and disruptive wildfire seasons that pose a danger to young campers paddling through parts of Manitoba, northwestern Ontario. And we actually have a friend there that their son was on a trip and he finally made it out. So she was ecstatic with that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was how to get them out and they had to paddle and they thought they were getting helicopter lifts and that didn't happen. And then they had to, but with the constant and just more frequent reality of forest fires and wildfires in the areas, we know that we need to take a different approach, says Sarah MacArthur, who oversees Camp Stevens, the popular outdoor rec center, children's camp administered through the YMCA. Over the past 2 days, they've had to evacuate campers on 2 canoe trips, boys' trip and a girls' trip, no more than 10 people each, because of wildfires in Wabakimi.
And this camp is Kenora, Dryden, Lake of the Woods area.
Camp staff received word in the morning that Ontario Park was going to be evacuating. Said we had outfitter who was generously helped to evacuate both our boys and girls trips. Then we ended up taking a float plane, a couple of float planes actually, with our gear and shuttling our boys and girls trips out of the area. Then they ended up in Sioux Lookout, and then our camp staff went and picked up our trips and got them safely to our island at Camp Stevens, just north of Kenora. Evacuation orders were issued for many parts of northwestern Ontario, as there are currently 165 active fires in northern and northwestern Ontario. The province's forest fire maps, you can check out all that there. Jennifer Magirovitz's daughter was two weeks into a Camp Stevens canoe trip before the campers needed to be flown from the area because of wildfires. A little bit scary to give your kids over to a care of someone else, and then when something so scary as a forest fire happens, it really tends to make you feel a sense of panic. My daughter said they could see ash in the air.
You're close if you can see ash wafering down like snow.
Our daughter went on a two-week canoe trip at Camp Stevens last year, enjoyed it so much she said she wanted to come back this year and do the four-week trip. Mother says the group is now back on the water, rerouted to Lake of the Woods area to finish off their journey. And a lot of people are doing that, too. They're, changing gears. Okay, you didn't get that, so let's finish off our
trip. Yeah, you'll still finish the trip. It's just going to be a new area, new location.
Yeah. She worries that this trend continues years with fire bans, wildfire smoke, and orange haze. Future generations might not get to experience a typical Canadian summer, something she holds dear. Having grown up in Northern Ontario, for me, this was an important experience for my daughter to have, and her kids might not have the same experience. A little bit sad when you think about it that way. Bruce Erickson, an associate professor at the University of Manitoba in the Department of Environment and Geography, says youth outdoor recreation camps are going to have to adapt to a new reality with more frequent, significant, and unpredictable wildfires. Well, that may be the thing is then when there's a wildfire that goes through this year, perfect place to take your kids.
If it ain't going to burn next year.
Not
going to
have a fire there next year.
I've seen, it was Jim Baird. We saw him go through a forest fire slash area in Quebec. Do you remember watching that video? So they had to pick through to find, there wasn't really clearly defined portages, so they kind of bushwhacked. But they went through a burn that happened just a season before, and his canoe, his backpack, his canoe pack and everything was covered in black soot.
Yeah.
He was just covered in soot. He just, you can't help but touch everything that burned, right? It was such a fresh fire. And you could see that in that video, you could see a few plants kind of popping up out of the ground, but it was mostly just stumps and soot.
That was us in Woodland Caribou. It's on everything.
Yeah.
You know, you're at the end of it. And there's these charred logs you've got to climb over. It's on your pants. It's on your pack.
It's covered.
You know, and then you look at your hand and it's like, why are my hands black? It just gets on everything.
And it takes, like, when we did Wabakimi for Burt Reynolds Memorial River Run, it was, we went into an area that we estimated the fire was about 10 years before or 6 to 10. And so there was some small saplings coming up, but there was just a lot of burn stumps. And you could see the whole area we didn't get soot on us because enough rain had washed off the soot, but you could see that it was within the last 6 to 10 years. So it takes a while to recover. And so when you think about these areas that have experienced this, Wabakimi, Quetico, Woodland, you said Woodland Caribou. Like it takes a while before people will come back because you're not there to see burned trees. You want it to be
Boundary Waters,
how
many people go there now?
Yeah. So currently Boundary Waters is closed. Mm-hmm. Quetico is closed. Wabakimi is closed. So the risk is so high. And plus there's, who's going to want to go there just to see burned trees?
Burned trees. Yeah. They're going to have to be a set of questions about how far you're going to go, what kind of alternate routes you're going to have, what kind of cost you're going to incur in order to be safe in these areas.
Well, they had to be picked up by plane.
Yeah. Erickson says camps will have to rethink about alternative logistics for trips, which routes to take and how frequently to take them, and timelines they'll need to have for getting people out of areas. It's not really something you've ever had to think about, but if this is going to be a norm.
Now it's, you have to plan for it.
Mm-hmm. MacArthur says they've had conversations about how their wilderness program will need to evolve. Of course, we will take any means necessary to ensure the safety of our participants, but a big piece of us securing and thinking about our routes is having access points, evacuation points. That's something we think of all the time. So really, it's looking at how we can adapt our program to the new realities of climate change. Erickson says, while many living in cities only experience wildfires through periodic spells of smoke and seeing people come from evacuated areas, the impact for people in more remote areas is much greater. So being on a canoe trip where you have to reroute or to get evacuated because of this might make you recognize that the impacts of climate change are really unevenly distributed throughout the country. It is possible that because the fires started in low priority areas, they became more pronounced and uncontrollable. Many of the areas these canoe trips go to are not high priority for forest fighting or immediate detection. And of course, the significant dynamic of that is the First Nations communities are the ones that are most impacted by forest fires and are most often impacted by the impacts of climate change more broadly as well. And climate change is becoming more and more and more every day.
Yeah, it's more prevalent in causes of these things. And when it comes to some of these remote First Nations communities, a lot of them don't have roads in. They're like, mm-hmm. It's like boats or ice roads in the winter.
Winter roads, yeah.
So they're very isolated. So it's not like you can jump in a car and evacuate. So they're trying to find alternate locations. Like I was looking at the map for the forest fires and Whitewater Lake in Wabakimi. There's Beckwith cabins that he died in the 80s. His cabins got burned. The Whitewater First Nations community, I haven't got word back, but it looks like from the maps that their community burned, as well as Thunderhook fishing cabins. There's like six of them on that lake. The fire, it consumed them, I assume, because you can see that the fire went right up to the shoreline.
Mm-hmm.
So these are fly-in only locations. It takes days to canoe in or canoe out. So to evacuate these locations, these remote locations, that's tough. That's really, really tough. And to recover from this is even tougher.
Yeah, he says, certainly feasible to start rethinking how we predict and fight forest fires in remote areas. And the fact that these areas are less populated is not a reason to not devote resources to them. We know that with the right resources, you can actually start to address these in a way that we haven't seen at this, we haven't been at this point in time. And despite observing how the effects of global warming are impacting our daily lives, Meg Irowitz is remaining hopeful for future generations. There's a lot of great things going on in science these days when you look at how we're trying to mitigate some of the problems, she says. And so, you know, there's always hope for the future generations to do better than we're doing.
Mm-hmm. I came across the one I saw was it's Lac des Mille Lodges, and so it is a place where you send kids to off for camp or adults go there for fishing and whatever. They're quite remote, but they do have a road. But they were doing photos and videos on Instagram as the fires approached them before they evacuated, and they saw helicopters land on the front lawn. And they thought, oh, we waited too long to get out. They're coming to yell at us. No, they came in. They put up 20-foot poles with sprinkler heads, and they surrounded the lodge with all these poles and ran pumps. And they put the pumps in, put the poles up, sprinklers on, and then they flew away. And they asked them, well, why are you doing this? You're accessible. It was the MNR. And so they said, you're accessible. We're doing this to any locations that are accessible. You had a large area for the helicopters to land, so the MNR was going in and actively protecting some of these locations, which is great. But they said they can't protect everybody because some locations you can't land at. So it's like, sorry,
we can
only help so many. We have only so much time, so much resources. But it was really cool. They showed the MNR setting up these sprinklers. They showed the sprinklers running, and then they evacuated.
Yeah, like I say, it's a new reality got to face with the camps and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, just regular people like us going out for canoe trips, you know. I know somebody was chatting with that said, you know, we're going in up north and hopefully there's no fires at the time or they don't come over that way and whatnot. If they do, we'll have to find a plan B or a plan C.
And if you're off grid, people can't communicate with you. You're looking at the weather. Like some of these people are on these remote lakes in Temagami or Killarney or whatever, and you don't have cell service. And it's like, hey, is that a storm cloud? Right?
It's not a storm cloud.
It's like, okay, we got to change plans here.
Yeah, I've upgraded to the Spot X.
Yeah, so I can people can reach out to you.
So people can say, hey, dude, watching the fire map, do you see all that dark sky? Yeah.
A storm coming at you.
Yeah, you better start heading back to your vehicle and seriously think about.
Which is good, and you need to have people at home that are aware of the fact that you're there and say, hey, do you know that there's a fire heading your way? Because I have Zaleo, and so I have a way of communicating in and out as well. Yeah. People can reach me by satellite texting or satellite emailing me on Zaleo.
Well, you know what, and I've been a big proponent of leaving that kind of crap at home, but if you're using it for emergency purposes, because there's people that, I'm just going to, we're having fun.
You're getting off grid. Like when I first got it, as Mike Burns,
you got to test it out.
Yeah. Mike Burns would attest. It's like, get off that thing. Yeah, I was on it too much, but I was learning how to use it.
Yeah.
And so, but the last few trips, I hardly touch it.
Yep. My spot unit stays on my pack or in the canoe or whatever, and tracks where I'm going so I can go look at my thing, and people at home can, he's following his route. He said he's where safe. He says he's going to be, and,
he hasn't moved in 3 days.
Yeah. Wait a minute. How come he's in the middle of a lake? It's like, uh-oh. that sort of thing. Like I say, I bring my phone for the journal. Mm-hmm. Aspect, so I can do my notes as opposed to pen and paper writing them.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And plus a quick, if there's something really quick, I need to whip the phone out and do photos or something like
that. I do photos a lot.
Other than that. And so like I say, where I'm going on my solo trip there is there's no cell service.
Mm-hmm.
There's no people.
Yeah.
Very sparse area. And if there's something going on, somebody can reach me saying, hey, you might want to contemplate getting out because all of a sudden
you might need to pick a new
fires.
Direction. Go east, go east.
Yes. So, you know, it's the new norm, as it were, right? We'll see.
I've heard stories of people who have hunkered down in a lake, just their eyes and nose above the water and, you know, trying to breathe in the smoke and waiting for the firestorm to pass. And it's like, that'd be scary. That'd be very scary.
Well, see, that'd be it, is if you're on the shore is the fire and you're out in the middle of the lake, you're thinking, oh, good, I'm safe from the fire.
Well.
But it's all the smoke still. You know, so you got to try to, even if it was like glass and you're not moving.
Mm-hmm.
You still got all that smoke.
And as I saw somebody spoke about it yesterday, day before, they said, the current, because it was, there was one day late last week where they said Toronto had the worst air conditions in the world on that day, just because of the heavy clouds. And if you see pictures of Toronto or pictures of Washington, D.C. with the yellow sky and so on, it's like, today's a 2-pack-a-day smoke haze. It's like, there's enough smoke that it's like smoking 2 packs a day. And so what you're seeing is people are reacting. It's hard to breathe. It's affecting your lungs. And so it's anybody who's at risk with asthma or whatever, then, there could be a serious health problem, right?
Yeah, and like I say, it's the new norm up there when you're on your canoe trips and stuff. We're going to have to start double thinking.
Yeah, not just checking water levels and water flows. Now we're checking forest fire predictions.
Right? New reality, dude.
Exactly.
What's next here? After a 6-year absence, an intrepid group of members and guests restarted the QP back to Batoche canoe trip by paddling along the same shores that 141 years earlier saw a force of First Nations and Métis warriors defend their way of life against Canadian militia forces.
And we talked about this last episode where people are bringing their traditions back. So renewing traditions, learn your past so you can know your future. So this is another example of that.
Over 2.5 days, participants paddled the South Saskatchewan River from Clarkborough Ferry, crossing the historic Métis community of Batoche, taking part in cultural teachings and learning about the history of Batoche along the way. From a medicine walk with knowledge keeper Justin Scott, to an evening feast accompanied by live music from Métis musicians Phil and Dallas Boyer, the journey provided meaningful opportunities to learn, share, and celebrate Métis and Indigenous traditions. For Deborah Marrier, Diversity Vice President representing Indigenous workers on the QP National Executive Board, the experience was about more than reaching Batoche. The canoe trip was more than a journey down the river, she says. It was an opportunity to learn from Indigenous and Métis knowledge keepers, deepen our understanding of this history, and build relationships rooted in respect, learning, and reconciliation. The Aboriginal Council of QP Saskatchewan organized its first canoe trip to Batoche in July 2003. That year, there were 17 people who traveled in a fleet of canoes from Saskatoon to Batoche. The group included QP members, First Nation, Métis, and non-Aboriginal peoples. Since then, the annual canoe trip has grown in size and renown. The voyage of 40 canoeists now begin at Clarksboro Ferry, formerly Warman Ferry and near the site of Clark's Crossing, and arrives 2 days later at the historic Métis community of Batoche. The canoe trip coincides every year with the Back to Batoche celebrations of the Métis Nation of Saskatchewan in mid-July. Purpose of the trip is to foster bridges between cultures and for participants to learn more about Métis culture and history, participating in Back to Batoche days. Water of the Great South Saskatchewan River are fed by glaciers and snow from the Rocky Mountains that flow through the Bow and Old Man Rivers in Alberta to Saskatchewan. Name Saskatchewan comes from the Cree word Kisiskiwiani Sipi, which means swiftly flowing river. The river flows through a varied prairie landscape from the southwest to the center of the province, where it joins the North Saskatchewan River near the city of Prince Albert. The river and its banks are home to a diversity of wildlife, including beaver, mink, badger, muskrat, weasels, golden eagles, pelicans, cormorants, spotted sandpipers, Canada geese, falcons, pronghorn elk, antelope, deer, coyote, fox, elk, and moose. The only thing they didn't mention was bears.
Oh, there's no bears.
There's no bears there. But there's pelicans. We've had those conversations. There's no pelicans in Alberta and Saskatchewan. Oh, yes, there is.
Oh, yes, there are.
Canoeists may observe wildlife along the banks of the river or an eagle flying overhead. River also played an important role as a mode of transportation for First Nations during the fur trade. Canoes and later York boats were used to bring supplies, hides, and pemmican to trading posts and settlements along the river. Participants on the QP Aboriginal canoe trip travel by river to Batoche in three segments. On the trip, participants passed through several historic sites along the South Saskatchewan River. The first segment, warm into the Hague section, Clark's Crossing, it was named for Mr. and Mrs. John F. Clark, who had established a ferry crossing at this point. The Dominion Telegraph Service set up a telegraph station here in 1876. It's a long time ago.
Oof.
General Middleton's troops arrived at Clark's Crossing, April 1885, to secure the ferry that Middleton assumed would have been taken by Louis Riel. Middleton spent 5 days at Clark's Crossing plotting strategy with his officers and by telegraph with the government. From this point, Middleton divided his troops, sent two columns to Batoche, one on the west side and his column on the east side of the river. Segment 2, Haig to Gabriel's Crossing. Middleton's camp and the Fish Creek battlefield. This is where Gabriel Dumont's Métis forces first clashed with Middleton's troops, April 24, 1885. On May 5th, the Northcote steamship landed at Fish Creek with supplies for Middleton's troops before heading onward to Batoche. Petiteville, further north of Fish Creek, had the west side of the river, is Petiteville, the Hivermont village founded in the late 1860s, where Métis family spent winters after the fall buffalo hunt. Gabriel's Crossing, this is where Gabriel Dumont homesteaded, ran the ferry from 1877 to 1883. Métis author and activist Maria Campbell now lives here, helps operate the Gabriel Crossing Foundation, a First Nation arts school. And segment 3, Gabriel's Crossing to Batoche. Now in National Historic Park, Batoche is a historic community of the Métis people and site of the Northwest Resistance of 1885. Town was originally called Saint-Antoine-du-Pontou, what was renamed after local merchant Xavier Letendre, who was nicknamed Batoche.
Oh, there we go.
Mm-hmm. Both sides of the river at Batoche, the Métis had settled on long, narrow lots extending from the river. Running through Batoche was the Carlton Trail, which extended from Fort Garry, Winnipeg, to Fort Edmonton, and was the main overland route for the trade of fur and supplies in the west. It was from both sides of the river the Métis and First Nation fighters fired upon the Northcote steamer as it approached Batoche. After 3 days of fighting, many Métis women and children took refuge for 2 weeks in damp caves dug along the banks of the South Saskatchewan River to avoid being taken by troops. Many became ill and died from pneumonia and starvation during the ordeal. A painting by Saskatchewan Métis artist Sherry Farrell Rissette depicts the story of the women and children hiding in the caves. Cultural and spiritual observances during the 3-day canoe trip. Participants had the opportunity to take part in Aboriginal spiritual or cultural observances. When the canoeists take their breaks on land, they may come across sweet grass, which is cut, braided, then dried for use in smudging and ceremonies. Sweetgrass, sage, cedar, tobacco are the 4 sacred plants used by the original peoples for ceremonies and purification rituals. Before these plants are picked, tobacco is placed on the ground as an offering and permission is asked from Mother Earth. Some elders teach people also to pray from the 4 directions before harvesting sweetgrass. Traditionally harvested mid-June to early August when the roots are purple. Sweetgrass should be cut at least 3 inches above the roots. Care must be taken not to damage the fragile roots. Sweetgrass is braided in because it signifies the hair of Mother Earth. 3 strands of the braid represent mind, body, spirit. Braided strand represents unity and strength. Sweet grass is always given as a gift or an exchange and is not to be purchased.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot. It's like they say, bannock. Oh, yeah. You never cut bannock. It must also be always be broken with your hands.
Broken, torn, yeah.
Like torn a chunk out, yeah. Stuff like that, right? The smoke rises, taking prayers to the creator, attracting positive energies and dispelling negative spirits. During smudging, a person cups his or her hands and brings the sweetgrass smoke first to the heart, second to the mind, third to the body, lastly to the heart again. Sweetgrass smudging is done to cleanse the mind, body, and spirit. Also done in ceremonies to open a gathering, cleanse negative energy from a home or sweat lodges. The Cupi canoeists have also gone on medicine walks with First Nation guides, discovered the medicinal value of other plants native to Saskatchewan. Traditional Métis food, such as bannock, is served to the canoeists for their evening meal. So it's a good little trip to do.
It is. And so it's been away for 6 years. They're getting back
to
it.
They didn't say why it stopped for, I got to think because of COVID.
COVID, yeah. So in 2020, 6 years ago. And another thing, I had to Google it because I'm thinking, CUPE, the CUPE canoeists. So I had to Google this. Like, what does CUPE stand for? Because I know about the union, but what does that have to do with the Métis? But this is the union. It's a union thing that they do.
Yeah.
So the Canadian Union of Public Employees, and this is what they do.
Well, it's the diversity part, right?
The diversity part of the union, yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool that they've started it up again.
Yeah.
I still got a couple more things to talk about here. Do you remember the fella?
The 5th of November?
Faked his death.
Oh, yes.
Faked his death.
I can't remember his name, but he went to.
Ryan Borgwart.
Borgwart.
So, he staged his death, fled to Europe to hook up with some woman and
that he met online.
Yeah, apparently things didn't go as planned.
More details comes out in this story than I ever heard before.
Yeah, well, it's been a while now.
It has been a while. People have been digging.
Right?
Yeah.
Some of the restitution from the man who staged his own kayaking death and fled to Europe has been used to purchase equipment that will help Wisconsin law enforcement in future underwater searches, the authorities have announced. 2025 Wisconsin court ruling, Ryan Borgwart was ordered to pay $30,000 in restitution to law enforcement agencies that spent 350 hours searching for his body. Funds were split between the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and the Green Lake County Sheriff's Office. Yeah, and we talked about this a couple of times. Every time there would be more update sort of thing.
I'm surprised he got so far as he did, considering he crossed multiple borders,
right?
State borders and Canadian border, and then went to Europe, and it's like you can be tracked, dude. Like, what are you thinking,
right? DNR announced that it used 9,000 of those funds to purchase towfish sonar. Unit can map the bottom of water bodies for missing persons, items, and hazards. If you are on Instagram, there's these guys that do that. They look for vehicles.
Yes.
And then they go down. They got the scuba guy that goes down and they recover the cars. And like some of these have been missing for years.
Exactly.
Sometimes there's bodies inside, sometimes not. So the towfish has already been deployed to 4 missions and located 2 missing people. Authorities say the equipment will increase the effectiveness and efficiency of underwater searches, reduce the need for divers to be put at risk. Towfish unit is a vital tool to our program that will assist in bringing closure to families and communities when tragedy strikes, says Lieutenant Drew Starch, who oversees the DNR's underwater search and recovery team. New equipment will be used in searches for the truly missing and help those waiting on shore. I like how they say the truly missing.
Yes.
Fake death saga began August 12th, 2020. It's almost been 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
2024, when Borgwart's family reported he had not returned home from a kayaking trip in Green Lake County, Wisconsin. Police recovered a cell phone, an overturned kayak, and a life jacket believed to be his. However, the body was never found. Police determined that Borgwart had used an inflatable kid's boat to get to shore after overturning his kayak. Then he rode an e-bike to Madison, Wisconsin, before boarding a bus to Detroit, then crossed into Canada so he could board a flight to Europe. I'm exhausted just thinking of that. Borgwart fled to the country of Georgia to be with a woman he'd met online. Police eventually made contact with him thanks to information found on an old laptop, and he was convinced by police to return home. Before he was booked into jail, police conducted a 3-hour interview with him asking why he concocted the scheme. He says he felt like a failure, having amassed a large amount of debt and that he didn't have a good relationship with his wife and children. Told police he'd accumulated $75,000 in credit card debt and $130,000 in business debt.
That's some of the details I didn't know before.
And now $30,000 in restitution, which is going to help buy a tow sonar. So, yeah. spent all that time looking for his body, and now he's has to pay that they can.
He's dug himself in so deep.
So like, $75,000 in credit card debt, $130,000 in business debt, and $30,000 in restitution.
Oof. Yeah, and plus other fines and whatever. Plus he's, you know, lost his house now. His wife's left him. His kids hate him, and yada yada yada. It's like, oh my goodness. It's like it's. I don't know how you can come up with a plan like that. Hey, I'll fake my death. Not going to work, dude.
Well, having said that, talking to people at work, and they were asking, hey, were you going on one of your trips for 2 weeks? I said, yeah, where are you going? Not telling. Why? Because after the week I've been having, I might not come back. And I don't want people coming to look for me. Yeah. Yeah, I've... You know what? There's easier ways to get out of things.
I know. Like, you know what? It would have been like, oh, I don't want to go through the embarrassment of claiming bankruptcy. It's like, oh, so you're going to cause, like, so much more.
International.
Wow. Everybody knows about this guy.
Has anybody talked to the girl in Georgia? In the country of Georgia.
Oh, yes, I know. We never got an interview with her.
I would like to know what her thoughts
are. I'd like to hear her side of the story.
I gave him the idea thinking, no, he's not going to do that. Because he wanted to meet up. I was over here. Said, there's no way you're coming over here. This Maybe you'll fake crazy. Your death and come on over. And he did it. What an idiot. I'd like to get her side of the story.
I know.
Shows up on her doorstep. What are you doing here?
Exactly. What are you doing here?
Right? He turns around. Nobody, honey. It's just a...
Wow.
Yeah. Let's get back in a little bit of more history stuff, shall we? Shall we? Paddling the slow black water of Ebenezer Creek feels like traveling through time. For roughly 13 miles in Effingham County, the creek winds through one of Georgia's, speaking of Georgia,
the but state of Georgia.
The state, one of their oldest forests, home to some of the last remaining old growth bald cypress and tupelo trees in the world. During Juneteenth weekend, Color My Outdoors, a nonprofit dedicated to reconnecting people of color with the outdoors, hosted a kayaking trip through the ancient swamp that holds both extraordinary natural beauty and the memory of one of the Civil War's least known tragedies. I've heard the word Juneteenth over the last while.
Yeah.
I thought it was just some funky...
No, I've been hearing about it for a while now. It's significant.
Juneteenth is an official U.S. federal holiday observed annually on June 19th to commemorate the emancipation of enslaved African Americans, also known as Freedom Day or Emancipation Day. It marks a date in 1865 when Union troops arrived in Galveston, Texas, to enforce the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing the last enslaved people in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize it was actually a holiday.
Yeah.
Or like a...
No, it's a federal holiday. Historical event.
Yeah. I thought it was just a... I mean, these days everybody makes up words sort of thing, right? And it's Juneteenth. Okay.
Yeah.
And that, I just figured that would learn something new every day.
Mm-hmm.
One of the important parts of our work is to tell the stories that have been lost and to rewrite the outdoor narrative, says CMO founder Simone Adams. Event draws experienced paddlers and beginners from across the southeast. On a hot Saturday morning, 14 kayaks launched from Tommy Long Boat Ramp for a slow 4-mile round trip led by two guides from Savannah Canoe and Kayak. Along the way, yellow-bellied sliders basked on fallen logs. Alligators slipped beneath the water's surface as kayaks paddled by. Herons flew along the creek. Songbirds called from deep within the trees. Every autumn, leaves fall from ancient trees, releasing tannins into the water, staining it a dark tea color and creating the black water that defines the creek. Ebenezer Creek's oldest trees spouted more than 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Those are old trees, man.
That's significant.
When indigenous people of the Mississippian culture hunted, fished, and traveled along its waters, centuries later, members of the Yuchi tribe encountered German-speaking Protestant refugees known as the Salzburgers, who established the nearby settlement of New Ebenezer in 1736.
So long ago.
Right? This is like so, so long ago. By the time the American Revolution, Ebenezer Creek had become an important route through Georgia's coastal wilderness, used by soldiers, traders, and settlers. Nearby New Ebenezer served as a base for British and Loyalist forces. In the decades that followed, the nation's fight for its freedom, enslaved people cleared the surrounding forests for plantations as a rice and timber industries transformed the region. Ebenezer Creek and the Savannah River were used to carry lumber, rice, and other goods to the port of Savannah. Near the Civil War's end on December 9, 1864, Union troops after marching roughly 300 miles from Atlanta to Savannah, arrived at the main swollen banks of Ebenezer Creek. Behind them followed hundreds of enslaved people who had escaped plantations, trusting that the Union Army would bring them freedom. Army engineers built a temporary pontoon bridge enabling Union troops to cross. As the Confederate cavalry under Major General Joseph Wheeler closed in, Union General Jefferson C. Davis ordered the bridge removed before the refugees could cross. Estimated 600 to 800 black men, women, and children were trapped between the flooded creek and advancing Confederate troops. Many rushed into the icy water hoping to swim across. Others were swept under in the panic. Some survivors were captured and forced back into slavery. No one knows exactly how many people died. News of the tragedy at Ebenezer Creek reached Washington, D.C. within weeks. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton traveled to Savannah to question Union General William T. Sherman about what happened. Stanton and Sherman later met with black ministers and community leaders to discuss the future of newly freed people. 4 days later, President Abraham Lincoln approved Sherman's Special Field Order No. 15, setting aside roughly 400,000 acres of coastal land for formerly enslaved families, giving rise to the promise of 40 acres and a mule. Today, the skeleton of an old bridge is all that remains of the site tragedy. For Leandra Taylor, board president of CMO, the Juneteenth trip was about ensuring that history is remembered while allowing people to experience the creek in a way that celebrates resilience. We really want to bring some visibility to the story, pay our respects to the way of joy and commemoration, Taylor says. For Adams, reconnecting people with places like Ebenezer Creek is about more than spending time outdoors. It is about restoring a relationship with the natural world where generations of people of color hunted, fished, farmed, worked, and lived before many came to believe those places were not meant for them. People of color are the original stewards of the land. We all have ancestral ties to that land. Many of us have been disconnected from that. We want to showcase that, yes, we belong in these spaces. We thrive in these spaces. We have been leader in these spaces and stewards of the land for a long time. 100%. One of the big things, and not growing up in a place, a melting pot, as the term goes, like Toronto, It seems odd to me. Like, I always grew up outdoors.
Yeah.
It's for everybody. But when I moved to Toronto, one of the big things was, and still is, no, it's just for the white people.
Yeah, it's...
And it's almost, it never really was.
No, it never ever was. It's just the way... You get stuck into a cultural bubble, right? And it really depends on where you grew up. If you grew up, I grew up in the country in the middle of nowhere in New Brunswick, right? So a lot of my upbringing, I experienced some French people and so on like that. But really, it was a lot of, we spent our summers outdoors.
Yeah.
We didn't play a lot of video games. We didn't hang out at the drugstore and caused problems and yada, yada, yada. But it's just, there's a lot of cultural bubbles that people get into. Chicago Adventure Therapy, CAT?
Yep.
The people that we interviewed. So I learned a lot there. I knew a lot before that, but I learned how they're trying to come around and fix it. So Chicago Adventure Therapy, they take inner city youth and introduce them to paddling, canoeing, kayaking, and so on. And it gives them an opportunity to learn how to get out of where they're locked into and potentially even becoming guides themselves and helping other kids escape whatever mm-hmm. inner city stuff that they're experiencing. So that's a great group that they had there. And everybody, I think these are the things that you need to learn. There's a lot of life lessons that you always have to learn from other people to kind of grow and make the world a better place for everybody.
Yeah, I don't think there's members only on the outdoors.
Nope, absolutely not.
I don't care where you came mm-hmm. from, with a race, creed, color.
Yep.
I don't think it matters at all. You want to go in the great outdoors,
mm-hmm.
it's out there for you.
Yep.
And especially with this, I mean, they got the history part of it.
Yes.
You know, to go as well and remember that history, get connected with that history and yep. realize this was part of you before, like a couple hundred years ago.
Yes.
This is what we all did
yep.
back then, and yeah. they were a part yeah. of it.
People, hey, I'm going camping, or as they used to call it in the 1800s, this is where I live.
This is where I live. You know, so it's nice to see stuff like this that people are getting out there and mm-hmm. and reconnecting, and it's, my opinion, it's beyond about time.
Yes, absolutely.
One last thingy here. Just an hour from Barcelona. So we're all over the world now. Valley of lush forests, blue pools, and cobblestone streets hides the perfect compass for getting lost and unplugged without watching a clock. It was once a symbol of drought, and now it's an ideal getaway. There are images that remain etched in our minds, such as that of cracked earth that not so long ago turned this corner into a sad symbol of the lack of rain. But nature always finds a way to rewrite the script, and the Sau Reservoir has regained its flow, restoring that immense, silent expanse of water embraced by the deep forests of the Osona region. Just an hour and a half by car from Barcelona, this landscape rises once again as a refuge where time seems to stand still, and the noise of traffic gives way to the sound of the wind crashing against cliffs. That sounds nice.
Mm-hmm. Very well written.
With the rebirth, this entire valley is transformed into a vast playground for those seeking fresh air and active tourism. Options for making the most of your days off here go far beyond simply gazing at the shore. Visitors can dive into the water to explore ancient submerged ruins, venture into the dense trails of the Calasacabra mountain range, or wander aimlessly through villages with their medieval charm intact. It is, in short, an unbeatable opportunity to connect with the natural and architectural heritage that lies just a stone's throw from home. The Sau Reservoir is a boundless playground for those seeking refreshment. Through the Club Nautic Vic Sau, or companies like Kayak Sau, you can rent canoes or kayaks to glide across the reservoir with a fascinating goal. And this is what attracted me to this. To paddle just a few centimeters from the bell tower of Sant Roma du Sau, an 11th century architectural gem was submerged beneath the water surface in the 1960s following the construction of the dam. Paddling around it at water level is a truly awesome, awe-inspiring experience. So basically, you're paddling out, you see this bell tower
mm-hmm.
above the water.
Yeah.
So you paddle up to the bell tower, and when you look down,
you can see the structure of the
yeah. rest of the church is there,
mm-hmm.
and there's other buildings, and so then the reservoir flooded it all yeah. out, because there's videos and pictures of that area being in drought,
yes.
no water,
yeah.
and you see this old town,
yeah.
and then when the reservoir filled back up, all you can see is the bell tower.
Yeah. It's pretty How wild.
Creepy.
It is. It is. Like
but
I've
it's
heard,
cool, though, with
I've
the mountains this, and stuff around.
Absolutely.
And gorgeous.
And sure, you're seeing a lot of this as droughts come and go. Like down in Nevada and stuff, we've seen, like, where there's Tahoe and what's the other?
Lake Mead, Lake Mead, Powell.
Lake Powell. So those are in decline. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the stuff that was underwater is now you can see again. I remember when I was in college in Cornwall, Ontario, the Long Sault area, it's a road and a bunch of towns that went underwater when the Saunders Dam was built. And I remember buddies would go scuba diving down on these buildings in the St. Lawrence River in St. Lawrence Seaway. So it's a lot of these rivers. And you can see the reverse of that happening too, as they take away dams and hydroelectric projects to restore rivers, like we talked about a couple episodes ago from out west in Washington State. So it's wild. The changing environment when water does ebb and flow, right? So mm-hmm. high water, low water. This church would be why. I'm surprised they left it and they didn't tear it down. Why they just allowed it to be submerged?
Well, it looks like it's made from stone.
Oh, so maybe they just right? yeah.
So they figure maybe it's hardy, over it's time, stay. Yeah. yeah, or it would deteriorate and mm-hmm. just crumble.
At low water, be interesting to walk through it, eh?
Right,
this thing's normally underwater.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, Sault Reservoir, S-A-U. Google that and check out the bell tower. It's pretty cool. That's all I got this week. That is it.
Yeah.
Finito.
My energy is lagging here.
Your energy is lagging. Well then, if you want to find out more about us, you can go to our website at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Well, and you can stream or download all our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Player FM, Podbean, Amazon Music, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com, and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.